This is At the Races with Steve Beck.
We're back about 10 minutes to the top of the hour, and as we mentioned earlier, and in fact, as I kind of referenced, you don't never know who, you know, who knows whom when it comes to the racetrack. And you know, Dick Powell earlier turning out to be a long time friend and acquaintance of Gary Palmisano Sr. But in terms of close association and families that spent time together and during Gary's training career, certainly the Krantzes, Brian Krantz joining us now to talk about Gary. And Brian, I appreciate the visit very much, obviously in close proximity to the news, but let me extend the condolences from fans and players everywhere.
Hey, guy. Good morning. How are we doing today?
Our mutual friend Chad Schexnader had let me know. We've been talking about the start of the meet, Brian, and he mentioned. He said, you know, Gary Sr.'s not doing well, and and so it's tough. It's sad news.
You know, Gary had a long, hard fight. I mean, he was 16 years ago. He was diagnosed with his cancer, and you know, he'd kind of been to the battles and through the wars with it, and talked to Karen this morning. She told me it passed last night. I got to tell you, it's sad, but I got to celebrate his life and our time together. He was, you know, one of those genuine guys from the track. He started it. You know, what we call here the old Jefferson Downs, which was originally Magnolia Park. It was a 5/8 mile bull ring, and his dad would bring him out, and, you know, he would walk hots and eventually started rubbing horses, and, you know, he just loved the game. He was a student of confirmation. He's a great sales guy. You know, we'd go to the yearling sales and just spend literally hours looking at horses and picking horses, and we had a pretty good record together.
You know, you had kind of a long, you know, long series of you know, just kind of just everyday horses that and good Louisiana breds, and you know, I saw, in fact, I've seen a bunch of pictures that you know, of favorite winners, but it. You know, it's obvious, Brian, that you know, the families, the Krantzes and the Palmisanos, you had, you know, it went well beyond the typical trainer owner relationship.
You know, I mean, well, Gary was our daughter's godfather. You know, we spent a lot of time together away from the racetrack, and a lot of it was spent with racetrackers, but you know, a lot of it wasn't, you know, one of the things when Chad called me about the show, you know, that kind of popped in my mind about the story about Gary was, you know, Gary had an owner from Slidell, and his daughter ended up marrying John Goodman, who lives here in New Orleans. And so we were going to go to the Saints game one Sunday, and I pull up at the house to get he and little Gary. And John Goodman, he told me, Gary said he needed an extra ticket. Well, here comes John Goodman. Well, we didn't have enough room in the car. So little Gary ends up sitting on John Goodman's lap all the way to the Saints game. And, you know, it was just kind of a comical situation and a fun time. And, you know, of course, when later on, we had Bill Hartack come down, worked for us as a steward, and Little Gary and Bill Hartack hit it off real well, and Big Gary too, and they would go fishing together, and Tack was a big practical joker, and you know, so it he spent a lot of time at their house, and we got to know him really good, but you know, those are the kind of things you remember, the racetrack stories and, you know, the interactions with the people.
Well, as much as we think of New Orleans and fairgrounds and, well, with your involvement, certainly, you know, Jefferson Downs even, but there's also some pretty legendary trips to Louisville for Derby, right? The annual Derby trip.
Yeah, we were... Oh, God, 17 years, we had a group of about 12 to 15, I guess, guys. Occasionally there'd be a girl, but, you know, it was mainly guys. And Gary, our group was a, you know, Buddy Deliberto, who was a legendary sportscaster down here, and his son Mike, who's a line maker at the fairgrounds, were part of the group. And, you know, of course, Gary, Joe Sherman, who's the athletic director at Delgado Junior College and the baseball coach. And, you know, probably the highlight of all those years was we would pool money for the Derby and bet superfectas. And I'm not a big bettor, you know, but, you know, it's Derby, so you open your wallet a little bit. And Joe Sherman, you know, threw his numbers in the hat. We all threw our numbers in the hat, and it comes out. And, you know, Joe comes up with a horse called Incredible Inc. And Gary said, I'm not betting on that. I'm not, you know, putting money, wasting money on that. And so the ticket was probably a couple $100 a piece. And so when the horses went on the track, I said, Gary, I'll give you half of mine if you want. No, I'm not doing that. That's a waste of money. Well, lo and behold, the damn superfecta hits and pays about $50,000.
64.
So Gary was nonplussed. And, you know, he ended up, without telling a lot of tales out of school, he ended up cashing the ticket and probably did better than the rest of us. So, you know, it was a fun day. And, of course, Buddy got on the radio that night. And, God, you know, everybody across the country knew that you know, we had cashed a big ticket. So people started getting phone calls, you know, naturally all of their racetrack friends and, you know, how that goes. People asking, hey, you got a few bucks you can loan me? Typical story, right?
That happens to be a that was my first Derby, and I three friends, we each put in $40 for 120, and we were going to do a 5-horse box, and it came down to the last horse in our decision making was Invisible Ink and Jamaican Rum, and ended up leaning toward Jamaican Rum.
Yeah.
Essentially, it unbelievably had the top six horses in the Derby, and ended up, you know, getting nothing. Pretty crazy. But so that's one.
Go ahead.
No, that one resonates. I know that.
Okay.
That really, I know that one intimately. With Invisible Ink, Todd Pletcher.
Gary knew too that I'm a history buff, and growing up here and being involved in racing, you know, you've got to have a understanding of history. And so, you know, in December of 93, the track burned, and it took us, major efforts to get it rebuilt, and we got back open November of 1997. So I'm sitting in my office, new office, and so Gary comes in and he said, man, I got a housewarming present for you. And it was a big, you know, frame that was covered up, and he says, look, I found this in a flea market. And so he opens it up, and it was a Times Picayune front cover of the day that Panzeretta died.
Wow.
And it was it hung, you know, it hung for the rest of our tenure at the door to my office. It was just really a special gift.
Wow. When you go to fairgrounds, I mean, there's so many historic. One of my favorite things is that display in the lobby of the silk tout sheets.
Oh, yeah, with the old programs. There was a Ladies' Day program that was produced in the late 1800s and the early 1900s. And it was done on silk, and it gave the day's races. You know, Fairgrounds was the first racetrack to admit women. There were some complaints because the women carried parasols to shade themselves from the sun. But I think the racing public eventually got over it because I noticed Keeneland actually hands them out now. And, you know, a couple of other things. Like, Gary was the last of his type of trainer, a small outfit trainer that had come up through the ranks that did it all himself. He never wanted more than 10 or 12 horses. And then so Gary's an Italian fella, and the guy, barn mate on the other side of the wall, was Connie Tisistro. Connie was one of those guys, when it was time to mix the feed, he'd lock the door, you know. And a little known fact about Connie Tisistro, when you think about trainer's trees, you know, you think, well, Dallas Stewart came up under Wayne Lucas. And so, you know, Brad Cox is a disciple of Wayne Lucas, and that's not the fact. I mean, the fact is Dallas Stewart came up under Connie Tisistro, and Brad Cox slept in a tack room in that same barn when he was coming up. So, you know, it's just, you go back and you think about these connections, and you know, Connie was a guy they called the knocker, and Gary was right in there with him, because they criticized everything that you could ever imagine. And so Neil Howard came to the track, and it was his first year, and we had some steps that went up to the dormitory in the barn, and there was a line to the clocker stand, so all the trainers would sit up there and watch the horses work. And Neil Howard's like sitting back in, because it's cold that morning, in the hall, and Connie comes up the steps, and Gary's standing there clocking a horse, and Connie says to Gary, says, man, you know, you see that guy, Neil Howard? Gary says, yeah. Well, he doesn't tell him Neil's sitting in the hallway right there. He said, man, he looks like the Wolf Man. And he says, what do you mean? He said, you see the way he shaves? And then he steps up, and Neil, he's looking right at Neil when he steps up on the platform, and all Neil could do is just smile. Connie turns up the way.
Well, those eyebrows will scare you if you're not.
Yeah. Neil was good about it. And then Neil, one morning, Neil got mad because the communication system wasn't working with the clockers, and Gary decided he was going to play a joke. So he got two orange juice cans and a string, and he hung them up there. And Neil was bitching, so he handed him one of the orange juice cans. Neil didn't take that one too well, though. But a racetrack can be a fun place. It really can.
Well, you know, we had Jason Boulay, you know, before the meet started, and I specifically touched on the fact, Brian, that I don't think there's a racetrack in the country that is as respectful and committed to remembering, you know, its most, you know, well-known and long-standing contributors. I did this with Jason. I'll do it again. The Joe Peluso Memorial, the Bob Wright Memorial, the Richie Shearer. You mentioned Buddy DiLiberto, the Spanky Brassard, the Nellie Menard, the Marie Krantz, the Fred Amy.
Yeah, our problem is we've got so many old contributors you can't memorialize all of them. But you know, there's a long history here, and There's a lady named Myra Lewin that lives in Lexington, Kentucky, and she worked for us in the press box under Bill Mooney when Bill was our publicity director. And Myra was our kind of historical researcher. And she's still doing some work for the publications that are in Lexington, but she and I were talking recently. When she was down here, she had come up with the first charts that we show for fairgrounds were actually run in 1820. And they would jump races. And, you know, she tells me at that time, she said, you know, we really need to make this public and let people know that fairgrounds is actually the oldest active race course in the country. And I told her at that time, I said, oh, look, I think we can document it. I think we can make our case. I said, but I don't want to create revisionist history. And, you know, it won't be smiled on. But, you know, the truth is racing's been going on here for, you know, well before anybody ever really thought that it was. And the people that have come out of racing here have populated the meccas. You know, his story, I could tell you a story about the Barrera brothers, starting with Angel. And, you know, Angel and a guy named Eugene Swartz, this is Frenchie Swartz that was the head clocker for the Racing Farms, little brother. And he was a horse trainer on the Leaky Roo circuit with Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons. And he had Woody Stevens Woody Stevens was a gallop boy. So this goes back. And so he had a horse. He was hiding because in those days, they really, you know, purses weren't real big. So that's what they did. And Angel Barrera comes to the U.S. and he's in the barn with Frenching. And they run the horse and the horse wins. Well, Angel claims the horse. So Frenchie goes and finds him and beats the devil out of him, you know. And so they get called before the stewards, and the stewards find Frenchie $100. So Frenchie says, well, here's $200. And, you know, whoever's receiving the money says, why are you giving me $200? He said, because when I find him, I'm going to do it again. And here's why. The horse ends up going up the ladder. And Angel gets enough money out of the horse from the winnings to bring Laz and Oscar to the U.S. Yeah. All right, so now you go down the road and, you know, Oscar becomes prominent, you know. But then you got Laz, and he sends this filly Tiffany Laz to Angel in New Orleans. And she wins all the three-year-old filly races, sure, wins the Fairgrounds Oaks. You know, goes up to Kentucky and wins the Kentucky Oaks and becomes, you know, three-year-old filly of the year for Laz. And basically the reason why was he was thanking Angel for giving him his career. You know, and there's thousands of stories like that that come out of the fairgrounds. You know, it's just, we touch so many people.
You know, I obviously, you know, saddened and to lose Gary Sr. But to hear, you know, to have this opportunity, Brian, is really wonderful. And I feel like I've been remiss to not, you know, to not have you visit before, because I absolutely, I mean, I love coming down there. And, you know, how important, I mean, the circuit, the whole Louisiana circuit is so vital. And I kind of, to be honest, it's almost a standalone, part of the racing landscape. And, you know, you're really laying out, you know, the map of why that is, you know, the people that, you know, that have made it up, and, you know, yes, people have come from other, you know, from other parts of the country and come there to train and come for meets, and whether they come every year or not, but it, you know, it's one of those places that just is so important to the game that kind of comes through. And when you think about it's been the theme all day, actually, has been talking about the families that that make up the game. And it's it's not so much a business or a career. It's it's a lifestyle for so many people.
Oh, sure. And I always kind of use the analogy. It was like running away to join the circus, because you had to be in the inside to understand, and once you got on the inside, it was just like that's what you wanted to do. The best day, away from the racetrack is your worst day at the racetrack. So it's just a great place to be, and it is, in my mind, it's a shrinking world, but for those of us that spent their lives in it, it's a great place to be. And Gary was one of those people that we'll miss. As I said, it's sad in his loss, and I'm very sympathetic to Karen and little Gary's loss. But you got to celebrate his life, and as part of one of those racetrack participants, and part of the matrix of why it's a great place to be.
Yeah, beautifully put. I asked Jason Boulay when we talked a couple of weeks ago. I said, "Is there going to be an Eddie Johnston?" And he said, "Absolutely."
The problem is you run out of races. Yeah, there's so many. I mean, Eddie and Gary were best buddies. That was the other thing. Yeah. They were always together. We'll miss them all. But God, they made it a good spot. And there's so many stories like that. And look, when you come down, I'd really love to get together. Maybe Mike and you and I can go get some lunch one day, and we'll swap a bunch of lies together.
It'd be an absolute privilege, Brian Krantz. I can't thank you enough for this. And we'll see you. Typically, come down for Risen Star Week.
Okay, good. No, please put me on your list, and I got 1,000 more stories, and Mike's got even more than I did. So.
We're gonna take you up on it too, because people love hearing it, Brian. That's the the people that love the game, the horse players and the fans. They love hearing it because they understand. There's a sense of the game's how special life around the racetrack is, and that's the key.
Of capitalism,
right?
It's the last vestige of true capitalism.
it's just as you said, once you get on the racetrack. I guess there's two schools of thought. Once you get there, you don't want to leave. But there's also the adage. In fact, Tommy Kelly said it. He said, for years growing up around Pimlico, I wanted to peek over the fence, and once I got in, I realized the fence wasn't there to keep people out; it was to keep us in.
That's a good way to do it.
Brian Krantz, paying tribute.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye. Brian Krantz paying tribute to Gary Palmisano Sr. and so many others. I mean, I'm going to certainly take Brian up on that offer to hear more. And of course, the Krantzes, they owned Fairgrounds and Jefferson Downs, and are absolutely woven into the fabric of racing in New Orleans. Yeah. Well, this venue, very similar to having that same, those deep roots in the community, and Rick Hammerly has made his way into that environment and part of the Oaklawn side of things.
Well, I've come a long way, and as far as that goes,
yeah, I mean,
coming from from recently, Santa Anita, where we had, I think, 13 bosses in 19 years. And then we were with Joe Harper at Del Mar, who has been there for 40-some years, a little solidarity. And then you come here.
The Sellers.
And the Sellers have owned and run this property since, I think, 1907-ish? 1905, somewhere.
1904, I believe.
1904, so 100 and, almost 120 years under one. And guess what? I think that works a little better.
That part of it, oh my gosh, the family that owns the Hawthorne, too, the Careys. The Careys have right?
Right.
It's the same kind of thing.
And so it's, and you just feel it around here. It, you know, I'm not in that, haven't been here long enough to get it, but you get the people that have been here for, you know, 10, 20, 30 years. It is like a little family here, and they're treated as such and just become part of the community, you know, as one. I wanted to follow up on something I said earlier about people are enjoying the view up here in the press box. I'll open this up. So any listener that comes to Oak Lawn and finds me, I'm in the racing office, you know, you can find me. Just say, hey, remember what you said about the press box? Can you take me up there?
Yeah.
I'll take anybody that wants to come up here for a nice little, during the races, anytime. Seriously. Just come find me.
And
if there's a convenient time, we'll make a run up. You can watch a race from up here and get the view and kind of, see what it's like to be up high and get the view up here. So that's a standing offer for the entire meet. So anybody wants to come by and find me here and say, hey, take me to the press box. We'll do it.
There, you know, there's some places where you can do things like that, including watching a race from the roof at Saratoga. That's a lot of fun. I don't spend a lot of time in press boxes. There's certain places where you kind of have to go. Pimlico. I broadcast from Pimlico's press box. And I've watched from the roof there. New York, too. Belmont, too. I mean, Belmont, you're so high up that you might as well be... You might as well be watching from an airplane.
That's true.
As far up as you are. In fact, I remember, who was it that... It might have been... Benny Stutz, Charlie's cousin, with Smooth Air. Was it Smooth Air? I think it was, that came to Belmont, and we went up. We were only in the third deck. And Benny was just like, oh my God, he had never been.
Yeah, no, it's a gift for you, and you know, when you work your way up through, when you're a racing official, one of the jobs you do is placing judge, which is either part of the press box or near the press box or with the stewards. So you kind of, you know, get used to being up here and looking around, but having not been up here for a while, you forget the dynamic view. Golden Gate Fields is a little different, where that press box is on the third level, nice, kind of past the finish line a little bit. But to get up to the placing stand where the stewards are, you would literally have to go up to the roof and walk across the top of the roof of the grandstand, rain or shine, windy or no windy. And it's a good, you know, 50, 60, 70-yard walk into a little, I'm going to say, like a train car thing, sitting up there.
Right.
And you have...
Like a boxcar on top.
Like a boxcar up there. And you are by yourself. So you have the stewards, the two placing judges.
The announcer.
The cameraman and photo finish guy on the finish line.
Yep.
The racing form guys, and then the announcer. So there's like 9 or 10 of us up there, and you don't move the rest of the day, especially if it's raining, and it's kind of neat up there. Where that view, walking across that roof, is just fantastic.
Because you're by the park, right? You're by Golden Gate Park.
No, you're not by Golden. No, because I'm at Golden Gate Fields.
Right, but isn't it? It's not adjacent to the park.
No, there's no park.
Well, the
no. If you It's right on the coast. Right. If you were to take a boat, literally, from China, go right under the Golden Gate Bridge,
right,
dead center, and just keep going straight, you would run right into the racetrack.
Right. But isn't there's a park that you used to drive? I remember there was a terrific Chinese restaurant we used to go to.
Yetwa. No, there's a bunch of Yetwas up there, but there, maybe there's a park
there's
now.
I'm gonna have to look. I'm gonna have to look at a San Francisco map. I mean, you know the town. I always thought
because it's in Albany. It's on the other side. It's in the East Bay. The track's on the East Bay. If you went under the bridge and kept going straight.
Okay, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's in Albany, and well, actually, the racetrack's in Albany, and the backside's in Berkeley, one or the other.
Okay.
So whenever we did dealings, we had to do two things. But no, it was a fascinating view.
I always thought it was on the opposite side. Well, where's San Mateo in relation? Because I'm going to ask you about Bay Meadows.
South, Foster City. South. You go across the...
Bay Bridge?
The San Mateo Bridge.
Okay.
And so if that's the Golden Gate, here's the racetrack there. San Mateo is down here with the bridge here. And whatever, the Bay Bridge is over here. But anyway, fascinating view. Come and see me with that, and we'll definitely get you the view from up here. And another update: we're not gonna officially announce the opening, but the calendar giveaway, which we're gonna do this year from Oakland again, we'll give away the Oakland calendars, and hopefully. Last year, because we didn't start until mid-January, so we didn't get the calendars out till later. I think we're going to be getting them at least towards the end of December, so we get them in the mail a little bit sooner. But we're not going to start it officially yet, but this year, what we're going to have you do to get the calendar is send in a picture of your favorite or goofiest souvenir.
Oh, that's right. We talked about the souvenir concept. I forgot about that.
So everybody has a souvenir.
Snow globe.
Anything you've picked up along the road somewhere from some goofy spot that's sitting on a shelf, got dust. The more dust, the better. Anyway, so you can't. No excuse for not having a souvenir and sending in a picture.
Everybody's got a souvenir.
So get ready for that. Get the picture ready. We'll probably announce it next week officially. So don't send anything in today. I don't even start looking at the mailbox site until next week. But we are doing it, and first 400, we'll get calendars, and we will run through that. You got lucky, Steve. You don't have to help me address them.
I've kind of thought maybe these next couple of days I'd have to do a few with you.
No, you didn't. I don't know. Who else you got coming on?
Just Seth. I got Seth, for his...
I got to tell a quick story here.
Yeah, go.
Because we're here. That Dick Powell mentioned something. On his about reading the racing form over there and with Hong Kong or Japan. So I was lucky enough to go on a nice Japan trip from Santa Anita many years ago. We have a sister track over there, Tokyo City Kiba, that runs
the Tokyo City Stakes, right?
So we run that, and they run the Santa Anita Stakes over there. And for years, they would invite as they would come in over to Santa Anita, we'd give them the tour. They would invite us. People from Santa Anita over to there, and I got lucky enough to go with John Niedowitz, one of the marketing guys. It was the two of us, and let me tell you, talk about a first class tour. You never get a tour like this with an interpreter and driver and guides and everything. So, long story short, we go to the racetrack, and I had to give a speech that night from the grandstand, you know, thanking them and for the welcome and all that stuff. But we get there early, and we're getting the tour of the backside. And I remember we're over there about 4 o'clock, and everything's the jockeys stay there, the horses are compartmentalized, everything's really regimented over there in Japan. And I remember going around the tour, and we were in some kind of holding barn, and first thing up, a horse winked at me. I'm telling you, first time I've ever seen a horse wink.
That's good.
I remember asking. What's the name of that horse? Oh, it's like the five horse in the first race or something. So, of course, I had to go bet on the horse. So the horse wins. 25-1, whole deal, you know, all this yen coming in.
It's so great.
So these guys think, and on my business card it said, racing secretary and handicapper. Well, I was the handicapper. I was a handicapper. So through the night, you know, I'm reading the form and I'm going this. I remember doing a back wheel in an exacta, and they didn't know what that was because I had some guy who was running the bets. I said, well, just bet all the horses and then put the 1 second. Well, of course, that came in. Long story short, we had a great night. And, you know, everybody kept asking me, who do you like, who do you like? So we get through the night. We're doing great. Next day, we go to downtown Tokyo to one of the OTB parlors. It's better, more than a parlor. It's floor after floor, just sophisticated information. Uh-huh. We're sitting there, and who do you like? And I'm getting out the form, and we're looking. And I hear some guys talking about the form. And I'm looking at this, and I call my buddy over. I go, remember last night? I said, yeah. I said, check out the form. Here, I'm reading the form like it is over here, top to bottom. Guess what?
It was bottom to top.
So here I was handicapping the night before, totally wrong, totally opposite, you know, hitting all these horses. Here, it was a big shot, total fluke. But it was I'll tell you what, I don't think we hit another horse the rest of the time, but it was classic. That moment of realization when the bubble gets burst that you really had no idea what you were doing, but it looked good. But they didn't know that. I didn't give that up. But anyway, when Dick said that, I just flashed back to that deflating time in the OTP parlor.
The realization
hit that, yeah, it was bottom to top, not top to bottom. But
The winking horse... Makes me think of Mrs. Weber and Ginny Moans, a horse at Saratoga during the sale, walking into the ring, winked at Ginny, and 1.3 million later. Charlotte had bought the horse because it winked at Ginny.
I'm telling you, it happened another time. And I'm trying to find it. It happened at Kentucky Downs, and I got a couple people that I said this horse just winked at me, and they won two and paid a decent price. So I'm 2 for 2 on the wink. So if you ever hear that, if you're with me, and that happens,
well,
hit the window.
The Kentucky Downs story. That, I mean, most people are going to be up for the year based on the Al Stahl horse. That
that's the horse.
That's what I thought. I figured that's who you meant. From that weekend, that was exactly the one.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. And I took a picture of it in the paddock, and I sent it. I said, this horse just winked at me. Jimmy was on there. Jimmy, I think Jimmy made a nice score on that one too. But anyway, you know, we talk about these stories, and you know, hearing Brian tell stories, it's a fun life. Being around the racetrack, it's not always funny, and it's not always, but there's a story everywhere. I tell people, look, you can go to a baseball game, you can go to a football game the next week, you can go to a basketball game the next week, and then you can go to the race for the day. And in a year, guess what you're going to be telling stories about? Your day at the races.
Yeah.
How you won, how you lost, how you ran into some, you know, some guy or some, you know, things happen at the racetrack, and the stories you hear are mostly true. They're so crazy that you find that they are true. I remember another story, a guy named Larry Howley. I don't know if you know him, a stalwart in New England, years ago, racing secretary. In fact, he was racing secretary at Suffolk Downs when Bill Veeck was there.
Oh, wow.
Fact,
so before Tommy Creel.
Way before Tommy Creel. 20 tons a day. What's the name of that book?
Yeah, yeah. 16 tons.
16 tons a day.
16 tons?
No, that's not it either. But
that's the song. That's Tennessee Ernie Ford.
Well, Larry, he was actually, when they did the Lady Godiva race, remember that when they had all the female jockeys? That was his deal with Bill Veeck. They put that on. He came to Monmouth later. When I first came there, and he was a little older then too, and he would tell these stories, and you're like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he told me one story. He goes, well, you know, Hammer, I used to be racing secretary at two tracks at the same time. I said, yeah, sure you were. Suffolk Downs, not only two tracks in two different countries at the same time, and blue bonnets.
Montreal, sure.
In Montreal. And I said, how did that work? They used to fly them from one track to the other on a daily basis, and he would... you would handle. They ran at the same time. I said, there's no way. And sure enough, I looked it up, and it was true. And he had some. He had a lot of stories to tell. And
that's the craziest thing I ever heard.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Check it out. Blue Bonnets.
Well, this is when Blue Bonnets was running thoroughbreds, you mean.
Yeah, exactly.
Because
yeah.
When I got there, it was strictly harness.
They ran concurrent with Suffolk, apparently.
Yeah.
You know, eventually going, yeah, sure, going to the back room, looking this stuff up. That was him.
Blue Bonnets would run after Saratoga because there were plenty of horsemen that would go up to Montreal after Saratoga. For I don't know if it was like a 3 week, if it was the September meet. I mean, this all predates my arrival in Montreal.
Right, that's why I mentioned Montreal, and I had never heard of Blue Bonnets, but apparently it's right on the lake.
Or a bay or something. No, it's at the top. It's right in the middle of the city. Pretty much, not in the middle of the city, but it's sort of like a midtown. At the top of the Jean Carré highway. She winked at me. The Winking Thoroughbred. That'd be a good name for a restaurant, yeah. The Winking
and
Thoroughbred.
You can see all the comments afterward. You know, they think I'm the greatest handicapper in the world. The horse winked.
Unbelievable.
But, story after story at the racetrack. So, you know, enjoy it. And speaking of stories... Not a story, but we're drawing the races here. We've drawn 3 days, and this track and many other tracks have been doing Zoom draws.
Yeah.
Just, COVID initiated where you know, you just don't want the people around. Well, we're back to live draws with COVID, and, you know, so the agents are back around, and there's people around at the draw, and it's the way it's supposed to be. You know, there's a lot of banter going back at the draws, yelling out riders, who you got, who's open, and things like that. So that's good. You know, we're opening the gates here, and we'll ask officially, but I think it's open season. I don't think we're limiting anything as far as coming in.
I haven't heard any of the new opening venues have any issue.
No, neither have I. So it'll be nice to see, and one of the attractions at Oaklawn is the fans. They come from everywhere, and they come in droves, and it's actually a treat to come out and see it and to stand amongst them.
Well, one of those that would make pretty regular visits here, and we got to get him back into the swing. Seth Merrow, who before I ever started going to Oaklawn, I was envious because Seth would go regularly, and here he is. Good morning.
Good morning. I am an Oaklawn fan, no question about it. I have a sister who lives up in the northwest corner of the state, up near Fayetteville, and so I made a couple of trips down to visit her, and then Oaklawn, and I say it often, Oaklawn, very, very similar. Well, history and all. Dave Hill had the great history of Oaklawn, but the history very similar to Saratoga. Mm-hmm. And so I was right at home when I arrived down there at Hot Springs.
When was the last time you were here?
It's been a while. It's been probably more than 10 years.
Oh, wow.
It is time for another visit. I'm envious.
Wow. I never would have guessed that. I mean, I would have thought... Although you used to make that family circuit, right? You'd Tampa, Albuquerque, Arkansas. You used to make that annual trek.
Yeah, I did a couple of drives down, visited my sister, then a little Oaklawn, some fairgrounds, and then over to wind up down in the Tampa area. So I had the three track circuit there. And yeah, my brother lived out in Albuquerque for a while. So I've said it many times. I visited Albuquerque Downs before I'd ever been to Belmont or Aqueduct.
So. which was a source of great amusement for me to tweak you.
You know that, Seth, I can actually say I did the same thing. I was at Albuquerque before I went to Belmont or
Interesting.
Aqueduct.
Interesting.
Or Saratoga.
That's funny.
On a trip east in 1977, I think it was.
And it's a really scenic track. And for folks who haven't been there, it's a mountain in the background, and the racing's pretty good. It was definitely a lot of fun. And I will say, I laughed at the I laughed at the upside down handicapping store. That was, that's pretty good. Maybe it's worth writing a book to come up with a new concept, upside down handicapping. Who knows?
Well,
maybe
I'm thinking, Seth, that if you're going into a little bit of a slump, maybe it's a way to get out of it. Start handicapping from the bottom. You know, I tell you, I had forgotten all about that till I told. Start talking about the races over there, but yeah, I'll never forget that.
I love that. Hey, I'm brilliant.
Yeah, no, I'm not.
I also can toss in a souvenir. Does a souvenir have to be a racetrack souvenir? Because mine is, and for some reason, I tweeted it out, a picture within the last couple of months, and I can't remember why I did it, but I had to look it up again. My best racetrack souvenir was when I went to Pompano Downs. This is going back 10 years or so, and I walked in, and I plumped down my $1.50 for the program, and the guy said, you get one of those. And I looked over, and there's this plastic thing there, and I didn't know what it was. It a hat? I didn't know what it was. A cake plate. I have the racetrack souvenir cake plate.
The cake plate? What? Are you kidding?
That's classic. And for the record, no, it does not have to be a racetrack souvenir. It can be from Dollywood or the Cumberland Gap, anywhere. Any, you know, cannon that you picked up or a back scratcher or, you know, anything that's sitting in a drawer, keychain.
Not a pen, though. Not a pen.
What do you mean not a pen?
I don't know. Not a pen.
You know, it's funny because I...
although I think that pen is actually... What did I give you?
No, not that kind of pen. That's...
Oh, this is a wedding. Crystal and John. I guess that's a souvenir of a wedding. I don't even know who this is.
It's funny because, you know what? Here's what I was going to say from one of my things.
That's more than... Okay. You know what?
That's a big pen. Big pen.
You know what? I'll ask the two of you. How many do you have of those pens that have the liquid and something that goes back and forth?
Yeah.
Yes.
I have a few of those, and I actually kind of like them.
I love them. Seth, do you have any?
Seen them, but I don't have any.
All right, I'll get you one. Next time I see one, I'm going to pick one up. And there's racetrack ones that have a horse that's going, or horses that are going, you know, down the stretch and then backing up the stretch. And you mentioned boats. That's a big one. And I'm trying to think of I got a really nice one that's on my desk that's in the pen holder. All right, so I'll back off my anti pen stance. I guess a pen is okay as a souvenir. I was at the Eagle game. I was, of all things, Tina got a hat or something when we were at the Eagle game in September. And I bought a pencil because I wanted to have one of those kind of throwbacks to when you were a kid. And you'd buy that pack of NFC or AFC pencils in September going to school. So I bought an Eagles pencil. That's, I guess, all right. All right. I'm better pencils. All right.
Yeah. Anything that a souvenir is defined of anything that you bought somewhere that you put in a, you know, a drawer and will never probably use, but it brings you happiness when you see it.
Well, people have seen.
Pencil
I put
and put in a drawer brings up a great kind of story. When my father passed away, unfortunately, but then the family was kind of cleaning out the, you know, my siblings and myself were cleaning out the family homestead, and down in the basement, my father had a little office with a, you know, a typical office desk, and we opened up the top drawer on the desk, and it was all golf pencils. There had to be like 300 of those little 3-inch golf pencils in there. Why he kept those, I have no idea, but it was golf pencils for a lifetime.
With or without the eraser?
Without, yeah.
No, the little...
I know.
Yeah, the little... Yeah, that's right, with just a little... it's funny, we ran home... there's a roll top desk at home in Connecticut, and my father wanted to make some room, and my mother used to use it. So Tina and I went to pick it up, and we had to actually take it apart a little bit. We had to take the roll top off and kind of make it to be able to bring it, because it was just to bring it, get it out of the room it was in. And then as we were bringing it back into the house in New York, something fell out of a section. And I didn't really look at it until the next morning. It was a book of stamps from like 1983. And I got the biggest kick out of it. My mother, you know, there were like two or I think there's three stamps left. And so I put it on a shelf because I'll never throw that away now. This is from the era before. Remember the era when there were no such things as forever stamps. Now they have these forever stamps. So whatever price you pay at the time, you can use forever. This is back when they would, you know, there'd be a. They'd raise it 3 cents or whatever, and so whatever the number was. But I think they're 25-cent stamps. And
Now, I don't know if that's a souvenir. Stuff. I don't know if that qualifies.
Souvenir of my mother. I've got stuff. Same thing, out of the desk drawer. From Pan Am. Yeah, my mother was in travel business. She had a Pan Am travel toothbrush where you open it up and it's the handle, you stick the toothbrush part into the handle but it's also a carrying case at the same time. And so Tina's like, throw that out. I said, I'm not throwing that out. Are you out of your mind? Throw it out. A Pan Am collector would probably love to have it.
You know, we're going to get some good souvenirs. Might have to have a top 10 list and give away some prizes, too.
There you go. All right, good. We'll do that. We'll do that.
And Seth, being up in Maine, you got to have some whale stuff up there, some harpoon pins or something like that.
Well, you mentioned snow globes earlier, and of course, Maine, you got to have, and I have, a lobster snow globe.
What's a lobster doing in a running around?
What is anything doing in a snow globe? I love snow globes.
Yeah,
I love snow globes. They're the coolest. Speaking of lobsters, I can remember when we used to summer on Cape Cod. When I was a little kid, we used to go to a place in Buzzards Bay, which is inland in the cove. But then later on, we used to a guy my father worked with let us use his house summers for a week or two, which was called High Hopes. I love how people with cottages, lake houses or cottages, name their cottages. To me, it's a very cool thing. It was called High Hopes. I've never forgotten that. It was one of the last houses before the dunes start, before Provincetown. North Truro, and I've got a lobster pot, a little tiny lobster pot with the netting, complete with netting. And there's a little, you know, little metal lobster that's on top of the lobster pot. And I've had that since I was 7 or 8 years old. I've got a whale. I've got a black lead whale that I remember getting on the Cape, or maybe actually Seth up in Maine when we used to go up there as well. I've got so much crap. And there's Tina doesn't even realize that there's boxes in the back room of stuff that that isn't even on shelves anymore.
She's going through it right now.
She warns me whenever I go away. She says I'm going to be throwing stuff out.
When we did the house cleanup, speaking of stamps, we found my mother had a whole. There were completed books. There were loose stamps. The old green stamps.
Oh, the
they
best.
They used to be able to put in the book and trade in for something. This was 40 years after the whole concept ended, but why didn't she go get an apple peeler or something? I mean, she had a bunch of full books, and they just went to waste.
S&H, Sperry and Hutchison.
Is that what that stood for?
Yeah.
Green stamps?
Yep.
Green
yep,
stamps, S&H, Sperry and Hutchison.
Yep.
I can remember going with my mom and dad over to
the Redemption Center,
getting a toaster or, you know.
Oh, the greatest. The absolute greatest. And my mother, she and I would sit at the kitchen table and fill in those books. And it's funny, you would when you were a kid, you would always grab for that larger, you know, the one that was worth 10 or 20, so that you could just do the strip of five instead of having to fill in all 20 of the little goofy ones.
What was that? They had the green and the blue chip stamps as well, right?
In some regions of the country, there was also a yellow stamp that I think A&P, I believe A&P had their own stamp program. Separate from SNH, but SNH was the Rolls Royce.
But we had the blue chip out in California.
The
blue stamps. SNH was different, but blue chip.
Interesting.
And did you guys in your part of the country? Because we had it up here in upstate New York.
Ask him.
When I was a kid, one of the supermarket chains would every Saturday run
the horse racing.
The Grand Union at the races, and you'd get the little card at the supermarket, and you'd try to hit the triple to get, I don't know, $2 off your next grocery trip or whatnot. But every Saturday, it would be A&P at the races or Grand Union at the races. They would show
King
like three races, and you had the little card from the supermarket.
No, I don't think, I don't remember.
It was in several parts of the country was a marketing gimmick that had widespread application.
And I remember the races were at, would this have been Calder? It was at that old rubber track.
The Tartan Surface?
Tartan.
Yeah, the Tartan, yeah.
That was the Tampa, right? Wasn't that
Calder
Sunshine Park, wasn't it? The original one that John Nehru developed,
right?
I thought that was it. I want to say Sunshine. Was it Sunshine Park? Right.
That was in northern Florida.
I thought around. Somebody will help us with this. Richard Kent, by the way, K's in sales. Richard, I want to thank him because he corrected me. I was thinking Jean Talon, but it's the DeCary Boulevard that runs north south in Montreal. And there is no lake by Blue Bonnets.
Okay.
Maybe a Trois Rivières, maybe a Three Rivers. There's probably more water potentially. Did you ever go up to Blue Bonnet?
No.
I never even heard of the place.
Woodbine is Woodbine and Fort Erie are my lone Canadian tracks.
No, Greenwood. John Fielding took me to Greenwood. That was I'm glad that that's on my list of racetracks. It's funny. John took us and we had a really fun night at Greenwood with the harness. And he told us to bet certain. He gave us a trifecta box, and one of the horses was like 25-30 to 1. So I was sort of hesitant to, you know, I didn't know how to bet it really. I was like, all right. So I kind of modestly, you know, dollar try box, and the thing hits, and it paid handsomely. And he said, "Did you hammer it?" I said, "Well, I got it once. I got it for a buck." He says, "Why didn't you hammer it?" I said, "Well, I didn't want to get involved with IRS." What are you talking about? You're in Canada. There is no IRS tickets. There's no IRS tickets up here. Whatever you win, you win. You walk out with stacks of cash. I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you one thing. When you go to a harness track and somebody tells you to bet some numbers, you just bet the numbers.
Yeah, exactly.
I learned that when I went to New Jersey a couple times. You don't ask questions.
Too funny. Seth, let's catch up quickly. We got about 6-7 minutes. How was Thanksgiving?
Very good. Favorite nice. Holiday. Apple pie, turkey. Love it.
Do you cook, Seth? Are you a cook? Do you do the cooking?
No, not turkey. There are some things I cook, but turkey I usually order out. And apple pie. Although, which ones are my sisters? My sister is an apple pie expert. Both of my sisters, actually. So, but hopefully I'll be down there maybe the next holiday. We'll get some apple pie. But otherwise, I buy out.
Well, to hearken back, you know, when before Seth sold the main house out from under Tina and I, our summer vacation home in Falmouth, I took a couple of there were recipe cards of Seth's mother that I copied. I've got her oatmeal cookie recipe. I've got her recipe. She's got something a cute name for Chex Mix. Scrabble. She called it Scrabble. Scrabble with pretzels and cheese twists and whatever. And you know, you promised me. You talked about cleaning the house out. You promised me that password game that was in the closet, and you never came through.
I have to see it. It may still be around.
That is a fun game. We pulled that out not too long ago and played that. Alan Ludden, in honor of Alan Ludden. Password.
And
Betty.
Betty's still around. A little red shield, and you can't read the. Yeah.
Right.
You slide the clues up and down.
Yep. Exactly. Exactly. That was in Seth at the ancestral home, at the Kenny Bunkport style, manse. They had that password game. I played it with Tina.
That's a great game. And I know if you actually had that original, that might qualify as a souvenir.
All right. Well, if Seth gives it to me, if then it will be a souvenir if he gives it to me. Seth, have you been? Have you gotten involved yet at Tampa the weekend?
The other day over the week. Well, a few times already, but I'm going to do some Tampa and some Mahoning on TV later today.
Ah, the old Tampa Mahoning double.
Double, yes.
I
can't wait for Oakland. I will say I'm thrilled about the early start this year. I love Oakland racing. I always think there's a lot of value. It's probably my favorite track to play during the year. Besides loving to go there, and as I say, being kind of a nice Saratoga-ish community and whatnot, having that kind of feel among the fans as well. I just like to play it during the year. As I say, I think there's a lot of value to be found out there.
Well,
if you show up, I'll get you up to the press box.
Sounds good.
Real quick, I just printed Laugh from last year and probably years past, but the first 10 days or so, who jumps out to the early lead, especially trainer wise, and it's not a big shock here. I got Asmussen, Diodoro were 1-2, and I'm going to explain possibly why that is. Obviously, they run a lot of horses too, but the condition book here comes out months and months in advance, which is a good thing. So what happens when those guys, they're able to cherry pick certain races because of the conditions here differ from day to day. Certain races where they can point exactly a horse. So the first 10, 12 days of racing, they've got horses already pinpointed for each race. As obviously the next book's not out yet, so they can't plan that far ahead. So, you know, it does even out. Yeah, they're going to run a lot of horses, and yeah, they're probably going to run 1-2 again in the standings. But they do jump out of an early lead, so they win early because they've cherry-picked a lot of these spots way in advance, and then you know the rest of the field will catch up to them. But just keep that in mind. And it's always like, oh, they won another one. Well, they've been pointing for these races for months for some of these horses. So it does even out after the first few weeks. But you probably will see these, you know, the guys with the larger stables winning even more frequently earlier because of that.
And I will say one of the things that always amazes me about Oaklawn, and Saratoga was almost comparable this year. I sit up in the press box and I would hear the call come in that there was, you know, a 13-way shake or something for a horse. And so Saratoga had a pretty good claim box. But, man, the claim box is on fire down there at Oaklawn. I had Hammer on with me. Was it last year, a couple years ago? We were talking about that. And then later that day or a couple days later, you texted me a picture from the office with the shake going on. It looked like a convention. There was like 20 people waiting to see if they won the horse. The claim box is just absurd down there.
Yeah, I thought maybe the first year was a fluke, but it got busier last year. It just is. One of the reasons is there's always a spot to run your horse back. You know, when you claim a horse, you like to think, okay, I'm going to try and run him here. The races go here, and so you're it's part of the action. People love it. They lose one, they win one. Every claim's a good claim down here because when you get one, you know they're coming back to run. So, yeah, Seth, I remember that. And I think we have, I had a picture of somebody, we had our 500th claim with about 10 days left in the meet last year. It's incredible.
There were 20 claims on Sunday at Churchill closing day.
Yeah.
20.
Well, then, you know, that's the end of the meet deal. They're trying to, you know, get them and get out here. But from day one, it's amazing.
What's the jail rule here?
27 days.
That's not bad.
No, 20, but that's to raise. I mean, if you can run back in 2 weeks, you just have to raise to 25%, like normal. But 27 days you're in.
You could go out of town with the horse.
No, you can't go out of town. 27 days meaning if you claim one for 20, you can wait 27 days and run it for 20 again and on the 28th day.
So they have to stay through the whole meet? What's the jail? The jail rule, so that if somebody claims a horse on Friday?
You can't leave town with our horses.
Wow. All right. It's a good thing Jerry Jim Gochian doesn't race here.
Guess what?
The phone's going to ring.
In about 10 minutes, it's going to be Jerry on the phone.
The jammer.
Can I get a couple stalls?
Seth, I'll mention, Gus Alonso's got action today at Tampa. He looked at the fifth through the eighth, or through the ninth, actually, the pick five and the pick four. What do you got at Tampa today? Or Mahoney, real quick.
I'll give a quick late pick four just because I think, and I'll just go through some numbers here.
Just numbers.
Just because at that sixth race, there's no getting past the critical way. And last I looked, scratches weren't up, so excuse me if there's scratches here. But I'm going to go four in race six.
Yep.
And then in race seven, 4-6-7. In race eight, 7-6-1. And in race 9, 6-5-4-7. So a 3-by-3-by-4 sequence with the single in the opening leg, the critical way. Just too tough to beat that one. So again, 4-with, 4-6-7, with 7-6-1, with 6-5-4-7, the late pick for a Tampa.
There you go, a $36 ticket for a buck or 50 cents for 18. And Seth Merrow, later on Capital OTV TV. Seth, we will talk to you from... Arizona Wednesday.
Symposium. Yeah, there you
symposium.
Go. Symposium. Yeah, nice.
Seth Merrow,
everybody. I'm envious of the whole swing.
Thank you. Seth Merrow, folks, let's pull up. And I want to thank Brian Krantz for paying tribute today to Gary Palmisano Sr. and thoughts to the family and all the friends. Thanks to Hammer, of course, and Sid and Dick Powell. Back tomorrow, we'll have full-fledged Oaklawn action, and we'll talk then. Thanks, everybody.
It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at pabred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them, is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.